Hi, and welcome back to Living on the Edge. I'm your host, Dave Sudia, Director of Developer Relations at Ambassador Labs. This is your podcast for all things related to Kubernetes, developer tooling, API gateway, and service mesh implementation. Let's get into it. All right, welcome to Living on the Edge with Ambassador Labs. We're back after a long hiatus. I'm taking over as the host here. My name is Dave Sudia. I'm the Director of Developer Relations at Ambassador Labs. And with me, I have Flynn from Buoyant. Welcome.
Hi there.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Always I feel very formal because you and I are friends. And
yeah, it's kind of weird. I feel like we should be just mocking each other or something, but that,
yeah.
I don't know, it probably wouldn't go over all that well.
Well, I know you very well, but for those of you, the people listening who don't, tell me a little bit about yourself and your background.
Oh, God. I'm Flynn. I'm a tech evangelist at Buoyant, working with Linkerd. In a prior life, before I came over to Buoyant, I was actually at Ambassador Labs, where I was the original author of Emissary Ingress. Before that, I actually have worked in computing for 40 years. That's 40, not 14, which means I've done a lot of, or at least a little bit of a lot of different things. And I kind of feel, some days I feel like 4 decades is about long enough, and some days I feel like it's way, way too long. So make of that what you will, I guess.
Yeah, that's a long time. So you are now in tech evangelism. You were, and you've been doing that for about a year-ish, a little bit more?
About a year and a half. Yeah.
And so for the rest of the 38 and a half years before that, was that all software engineering?
I actually started as a systems administrator.
Okay.
These many years ago, and did that for a little bit before changing over to be a professional software developer person. When I started, the term software engineer did not exist. So I actually went from being a systems administrator for a while to being a computer programmer. And then we started talking about software engineering as computer programming became more and more passe or something.
So I want to dive into that a little bit because, of course, now if you were a sysadmin, you would have been called a DevOps engineer. That's what that turned into.
Probably, yeah.
And it's great that you got out of that before that happened.
You mean before DevOps was dead?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God. Let's not dive into that.
Let's not.
Just, yeah.
I mean, it'd be fun, but let's not.
Yeah. So essentially, you did ops first, but in a time when it was very different. But then shifted over. So what was that like? I'm going to talk about another transition later, but tell me about that transition.
That was really, really different, I think, from what it would be like today.
Sure.
I think it's... Yeah, I haven't really tried to think about how to summarize that transition in a long time, which is why I'm just sitting over here and saying a lot. It's interesting to think that I don't think the distinction between administration and operations is as minor as you might otherwise believe, thinking okay. about a sysadmin versus, you know, a DevOps person, right? I do think that, you know, there's still an attitude among some of the software engineering folks that the ops side is somehow the lesser brethren of the software engineers. And I think that was even more prevalent back sure. when it was sysadmin instead of ops. But there was, I think the biggest shift was for me at that time was probably getting to a place where I wasn't touching hardware or wires or anything like that. And suddenly I was one of the folks who was responsible for deciding how the wires and such should be connected and what they were going to do and things like that. And so it felt like a really big change. I've heard it said that the really great sysadmins are all programmers as well, and the really great programmers have all spent time as sysadmins. I think that's very much true.
Sure.
I think the perspective about how things go on the other side of the wall is still really, really valuable. I think there's a lot of value in that. And
yeah,
we didn't
totally
talk about it much back then, but it was
really... Well, I mean, because the point of DevOps was to break down the wall, but let's be honest, in any significant, you know, large enough organization, no one can know everything. And yeah, so it really just becomes about improving the communication, you know, and trying to have the wall be made of glass. having the experience on both sides, you know,
yeah,
helps massively.
Yeah. I often have described DevOps as a concept, as the radical idea that the devs and the ops folks should actually trust each other to be, you know, both working in the best interest of everybody and to get each other's, you know, to get their jobs done, right? That idea of dev and ops actually trusting their counterparts on the other side of the wall, no matter what the wall is made of, I still feel like that's something we got to work on.
Yeah.
More than, you know, I don't really feel like that's a solved problem yet.
No, it's a human problem, so I don't know that it'll ever be solved. But
I doubt it. Yeah. I think we could do things to...
Worth the effort to make it better, is what you know.
Yeah. And I would like to hope that we can do things with, you know, providing better perspective so that it's easier for the developers to understand that, hey, the ops folks have a real job and it's very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, you need to respect the fact that they are doing something really difficult and holding it all together. And, you know, likewise, the ops folks should probably understand that the software engineers have a real job too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I spent 2 hours yesterday trying to figure out Route 53 hosted zones. So ops is hard.
Ops is hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel for you and I'm sorry you had to burn those 2 hours that you're never going to get back.
Yeah. And so is making an app that works. So yes, yeah. I agree with you. That's it's on both sides. Yeah. You know, and heck, I'm not even doing real ops here. I'm just trying to like promote things. So on that note, so as a more recent transition from software engineering into tech evangelism, what has that been like for you?
That's a little, I don't feel like that was as abrupt a transition as people always assume, because especially towards the tail end of my tenure at Ambassador Labs, I was doing some of the evangelism anyway.
Right? Sure.
But it's funny. I think the most fascinating thing about that transition for me has been that I have to remind myself every so often that I am no longer part of the engineering organization.
Indeed.
And on the one hand, this is really nice, right? My life is no longer ruled by sprints.
You are no longer on call.
I am no longer on call, which is, oh dear God, that is a beautiful, beautiful thing, right?
I was talking to a colleague recently at another old ex-colleague, and we're still friends, and she was telling me I could be making so much more money if I did X or Y or Z, and I said, yes, but the most pressing thing I have to do right now is write blog posts. And and yeah, you had to put off this dinner for 3 weeks because you've been on call.
Right. And lest anybody get the wrong idea, that is not Dave and I implying that writing blog posts is easy. It turns out that wrangling English is difficult.
No, it turns out that's the part of this job I'm the worst at.
Yeah.
It was the most pressing thing. It was still, yeah.
Yeah, it can be tough, right? I mean, the stuff that I've done recently has mostly been writing a lot of English. I put together a demo that I had to do earlier today. But honestly, Regina Scott from one of the Argo maintainers did an enormous amount of the work on that demo, which was beautiful. Even at that, going through and doing the demo, and there's a lot of points when you're putting the demo together, you're kind of like, okay, wait a minute, how are we going to talk about this? It's not, how do we get the demo to work? It's how do we explain what's going on? This, you know, this business of tech evangelism that's figuring out how things work and then figuring out how to explain it to people. Yeah, that's a challenge.
It's teaching. No, and that's where I feel like coming into this role, you know, because I got hired into this role based off of my teaching or talking at KubeCon a lot and other conferences and stuff. And I think that that's the thing I've learned is that I was hired for talking and then I was asked to write. And then I learned my limitation. Because I think by talking.
Oh, that's brutal.
So that part's a little. and I have a background in teaching. And so I do love teaching people by talking at them. So
teaching is a lot of fun when you're dealing with people who want to learn things.
Oh, yeah.
And
for sure.
I've generally had the luxury that when I am teaching, it's teaching people who want to be there and want to learn, which is really nice, actually.
Okay. So here's another question for you on that topic is, you know, so we're both at places that have open source projects that have been donated to CNCF. We both, and then, you know, our companies both offer paid products on top of that. How do you balance that? How do you balance the open source versus the paid? And, you know, I think people, some people are more touchy about it than others. And, you know, but at the end of the day, we're all looking for solutions and we all know that, you know, there are reasons to buy software. So what's your take on that?
My take is that there are reasons to buy software and people should pay attention to those reasons and they should buy it when it makes sense. And obviously snide's probably not the right word there, but that's the very most biased way I can present that, right? I think that open source software has a much better track record than closed source software in basically everything that I think is important.
Sure.
Particularly in terms of security and reliability, I think open source software works better than the closed source model. Now, that being said, what was that line from Serenity? Powerful need to eat sometime this month. You know, bills to pay, got a kid, got a family, got a mortgage, we have a dog, you know. And the reality is that...
My dog has three kinds of allergies that require several expensive shots, so I feel you there.
Oh, yeah. Ouch. My dog, thankfully, does not seem to have any allergies, which also makes me very happy. But yeah, there's basically nobody who can work on open source software and never get anything in return for it and do that for longer than a couple of months.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
So it is interesting. I think that for both Buoyant and for Ambassador Labs, having the open source product and working on an open source product that they now do not own, that's another thing that I think gets lost in translation a lot, right? Buoyant does not own Linkerd. And I may have just lost that. Buoyant does not own Linkerd. Ambassador Labs does not own Emissary anymore.
Yeah.
And so both of those companies are spending a fair amount of bandwidth working on products that they don't actually own. But that seems to work out pretty well because it gives us, on the one hand, it gives us the ability to provide something to people that helps them. And it gives us a way to talk to them about ways that they can support us in giving them something that helps them. So seems to work out okay. I know people who are very, very touchy about not wanting to even mention the paid stuff while they're talking about the open source stuff. And I am not that touchy. I am generally perfectly willing to talk about the paid products while doing a workshop for the open source stuff.
Thing. That's why I felt safe asking. So I think on that note, you know, so you were the original author on Emissary and you're still a maintainer. I'd love to know what you think of, you know, you and I were just speaking the other day about the maintainer track talk for Emissary coming up at KubeCon. And one of the things we talked about was just it's stable.
Yeah.
And I'm asking some questions here that set the groundwork for some questions I'm going to ask later, but
great.
In a good way, it's like,
so all good
for everyone else, for the listeners reference, I have been using Emissary Gateway since Emissary Ingress since 2018 when it was just Ambassador API Gateway. And so that means that
Dave was using it back in the really early days.
Early days. There were five.
It was a much rougher, much more difficult to use product than it is now.
Yes. So but Dave even with that, I will say that it's, you know, as far as Kubernetes tooling goes, which will set the bar low, it's really nice to use.
That's a really low bar, Dave. Thanks, yeah. I think.
I was, the API is good. You know, like the interface is good. And so, yeah, I don't have you seen, but I think to that thing of like, it was rough, it's better. Have you seen it evolve? Where are we at now?
I actually did a whole talk on this at KubeCon in Barcelona, which I think was, that might've been 2018, actually.
Yeah.
I think it was. And we should probably find a link to that and put it up. But one of the really interesting things about that was realizing that I think I actually ripped off Kierkegaard in the talk and talked about how, you know, you can only understand this stuff backwards, but you have to write it forwards. And it was very interesting looking back and kind of realizing like, oh yeah, we started off during this period where we were experimenting, trying to figure out what would work for people. And then suddenly we realized, oh crap, people are using this. Now what do we need to do? You know? And
it's so okay, you put alpha in the API title. So, you know,
So clearly we're safe, right?
It's time to put it in production.
exactly. Once you get to 0.5, baby, the first release of Emissary of, you know, Ambassador API Gateway at the time, the first release was actually early in 2017. And there was a long period of frantically making it so that it was something that people trying to use it in production could rely on.
Yeah.
Even things as basic as, oh, maybe we should run tests in CI, you know, things like that. Because, you know, I mean, very few software projects, those of you who have not worked on open source software, very few of them start with people sitting down going, oh yeah, let's do CI first. Because you kind of first have to have something that you know enough about to be able to test.
Yeah.
And that's another dirty little secret of software is that when you start off, the developers don't understand the product very well either. And
yeah.
So after that came a long period of basically, and honestly, this is kind of the position the Gateway API is in right now, of trying to go through and add all those things, all the features and functionality that people need to be able to use your product in Angular. And then after we got to that point, we could start thinking about going through and trying to polish off the last of the rough edges and things like that. So at this point, Emissary, I think, is in a place where there are features that would be nice to add. But I think it has everything that people need to be able to use it as a Kubernetes API gateway. Yeah. I think it has all of those things, and I think that it works fairly well for those things. I should probably also caveat that last bit with one of the really interesting things that happens when you are, especially an early developer, my mental image of Emissary is always that it's this piece of software that doesn't work very well because the only things that I ever work on in the code are things that aren't working, right? And so funny. I have to stop and remind myself, actually,
a ton of people run millions of requests per second through this thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we actually had a guy once walk up to us at KubeCon and say, oh, you guys do Emissary. And we went, yeah, do you use it? He says, yeah, I run 500,000 requests per second. And we went, wait, what?
It works that well?
Talk to us about how you did that. How does that work? You know? Yeah. Cause it was, you know, you tend to hear, as a developer, you tend to hear from people who are unhappy about your product.
Yeah.
Because the people who are unhappy are the ones who file bugs and come to you with issues and open up discussions going, oh, you should really do this. It's one of the things I love about KubeCon is that you get to talk to people for whom it's working well.
Yeah.
And it turns out there are a lot of those people. That was really cool.
Yeah. Whenever you create something and you get to see someone else enjoy it, or use it or be happy with it, that is always one of the best feelings.
It's a pretty awesome thing. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is, you know, that idea of Emissary kind of shifting from, oh, we've got to add more stuff to it, into the mode of, oh, there are some rough edges that we should look at. Right.
Yeah.
That's a pretty significant transition, actually.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to kind of look back and realize, oh yeah, that happened a little while ago. That was another thing about software, realizing you don't see these transitions until they're in the rearview mirror.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the getambassador.io CRDs?
I am biased. I am obviously extremely biased about the getambassador.io CRDs because I invented a lot of them. And there are absolutely things about them that I don't like all that much. But I have always been pleased about the fact that you can do basic mappings in a small number of lines that just kind of make sense and you don't have to think too hard about them. Sorry, one other interesting thing about that, kind of getting back to the teaching aspect of things and the tech evangelism thing, and you know, people outside Ambassador Labs, like, you know, people we would go through and talk to at KubeCon and such, would fairly regularly say things like, you know, oh yeah, the code on this seems like it must have been really hard. And many times they were surprised to hear that, no, actually the code in Emissary is mostly fairly straightforward. There are some big notable exceptions to that statement, but mostly fairly straightforward. No, the hard part of Emissary was always coming up with a set of semantics that matched up with Envoy semantics, but that we could explain to people, like, you know, your new grads at Upchieve, so that the people trying to use it could understand how to use it and be able to use it. That was always the hard part. And, you know, I don't think that software in general is... It's unclear to me that software in general is going to be making that part easier anytime soon. It is clear to me that a lot of projects don't think very hard about that part. Every so often I'll get questions about, oh, I need a good Kubernetes 101. And to this day, I don't have anything really good to point them at, which is actually really frustrating, and we should do something about that. But it is interesting to take Emissary and Linkerd and look at them through that lens, because for both of those tools, that was an intentional choice in design. Now, in Emissary's case, it was almost a default intentional choice because, you know, it's not like all of us were Kubernetes experts when we started off. And so we started off building something that we could use to solve real problems for us in Kubernetes. And very early on, we came up with, this is in like June of 2017. I had to go and talk about Emissary, or talk about Ambassador API Gateway, at an Istio day, actually, an Istio day conference that was supposedly talking about Ingress. And I had to figure out how to talk about what was actually different between Istio's Ingress and Ambassador API Gateway in a way that wasn't just, well, we're better. And that was where Jane, the app developer persona, came from, because I realized that was the set of choices that we were doing, was imagining this very busy developer who viewed all this Kubernetes stuff as friction. And we had already at that point and kind of embraced this idea of, okay, well, if we look at this from Jane's point of view, how well does it work? With all the best intentions in the world, you cannot actually deploy an API gateway in production if you cannot do things like WebSocket upgrades, if you want them, or, you know, Linkerd had a similar sort of thing, except that with Linkerd, the Linkerd that everybody knows today is Linkerd 2, not Linkerd version 1, which was a very, very different product. And Linkerd 2, especially with the experience from Linkerd 1, the designers sat down and went, no, we are going to make operational simplicity a paramount concern, where the point of a service mesh is to reduce complexity in your world. It should not be adding more complexity in your world. And so they kind of approached it from that direction rather than doing the persona-based thing. But you get to the same place, which is that you need something that you can gain benefit from if you're a four-person startup with no spare cycles and you don't have the budget to hire an army of SREs. And the thing that I really like about this one is If you sit down and you talk to the engineers at Buoyant who did the multi-cluster implementation, oh my God, the rabbit holes are not to be believed. There's just, wow. I've had a number of discussions on a couple of things as we, especially as we start going through and thinking about things like mesh expansion, where we want Linkerd to be able to extend the mesh onto a virtual machine, for example, or a real machine outside your cluster. And at that point, whether your workload is in Kubernetes or not, all the Kubernetes part of your app is just going to talk to it as if it were in the cluster. It'll be really nice. But the amount of networking detail and knowledge that is buried in all of these things I just described is not to be believed. But the user interface is, you type Linkerd multi-cluster link, and then you put a label onto a service, and it's done.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways to approach it. Speaking of approaches, one of my favorite things is how you approach APIs and how they're designed. The emissary CRDs are, I think, just really excellent examples of that. Can you share your approach?
The idea that your APIs form an interface that humans have to use, and therefore they are a user interface, is a thing that does not seem to get a lot of attention yet. And that can be very frustrating. You don't get good results. If we want to be a little over the top about it, we can point out that, the way I've often put this in internal conversations is that, developers are not normal human beings. Obviously, again, said with all the love in the world, because I spent decades as a developer, but every developer should have the experience of having to support an end user who has no expertise in how your product was built. All they know about is what they want to do, and they know your product and they see its documentation. Every developer should need to support somebody trying to get something done with their product, because it is an eye-opening experience. It is rarely a pleasant or comfortable experience, but it is definitely eye-opening. I think one of the things that makes the cloud native world, computing in general, but definitely the cloud native world, is made very complex by the fact that it moves really, really fast and things change a lot. The biggest stuff that we rolled out, and we demoed some of this in KubeCrash, this, if anybody is interested in KubeCrash, go to kubecrash.io. And you should find recorded sessions there. But one of the things that we did in this one was we demoed having CockroachDB and Linkerd and Emissary all working in the same multi-cluster setup to do a multi-cluster application. Because this is also something I think is often missing from the industry, is this whole concept of, maybe we should talk about how to do things when more than one product is involved, as opposed to just doing the toy setups with one product. There will be an ebook for that KubeCrash, just like there will be an ebook for the previous KubeCrash. And one of the things I'm kind of looking forward to in the multi-cluster ebook is getting to wrap in some of the other products that we didn't really have time for, so that we can do more of the real world setup there. But in that one, we had three clusters which were working as, we didn't actually set them up in these regions, but the idea was that we had one in, US West, like San Francisco, one in US East, one in EU Central, and all of them could share a database, all of them could do things. Emissary arranged it so that if you were a European user and you logged in accidentally hitting one of the US emissaries, you'd get redirected over to the European one so that we could be talking about GDPR and all that kind of stuff. And Linkerd was, one of the really fascinating things when you look at Linkerd and an emissary in those is that actually, this is true pretty much every time you have Emissary and Linkerd working together. the way Emissary and Linkerd work together is that you put them both in a cluster and they just work. Yeah, you don't have to do anything magic to tell Emissary, oh, you've got a Linkerd. You just put it in the mesh and tell it to route and you're done. Same thing. You don't have to tell Linkerd anything special about, oh, this is an Emissary. It's just another meshed workload. It's great. So all of the communications where Emissary needed to cross clusters, Emissary just routed to a workload and let Linkerd worry about the cross-cluster business. Cockroach, likewise, just would talk to nodes and didn't realize that they were in different clusters necessarily. There's database setup you can do under the hood to tell it things like, hey, you're a node in this region, so do compliance this way, you know. But that showed off a couple of features that I now think of as second nature, but which are actually pretty advanced. One of them was, being very articulate here, you can tell. Linkerd prior to version 2.14 did multi-cluster by basically having gateways in each cluster, and then it could mirror services and it would route things through the gateways to the other cluster. And this works very nicely. It does introduce a little bit of latency. It makes it considerably trickier to know the mesh identity of the caller if you have to cross clusters. And for both of those reasons, we introduced what I tend to call flat network multi-cluster, where if you have connectivity such that a pod in one cluster can talk directly to a pod in another cluster, then Linkerd gets to just get rid of the gateways, do service mirroring for you, and talk directly across. And that's actually really cool because we can do things like mesh level authorization across clusters without having to spend a lot of brain power on the fact that it's, you know, that identity is in another cluster. But the other thing that was demonstrated in KubeCrash that we didn't really make a big deal about is that the old way and the new way actually coexist seamlessly in the same multi-cluster setup. So for various reasons dealing with headless services, Cockroach was actually using the old gateway mechanism and Emissary was using the non-gateway mechanism, at least when we did it, you know, when we had that. The Sivo clusters we were using, we actually had Emissary using the old way as well. And Dave probably never noticed that at all.
All right, changing the subject a bit here. We all know that KubeCon's coming up, and at KubeCon, they're going to be announcing the GA of the API gateway. It's going 1.0. It's a big thing. What are your thoughts on that announcement?
A gateway API is not very straightforward. I would like for gateway API to be something that is extremely usable by everybody in lots of different fields. And as far as biases from my perspective go, I'm one of the co-leads for the Gamma project, which talks about gateway API for service mesh. And that has resulted in me spending a lot of time with the co-leads of Gateway API. And in fact, I was there for the API review for Gateway API 0.8 and for Gateway API 1.0, kind of in that Gamma E capacity. And I regularly feel bad about the fact that when Gateway API got started, I was two heads down with Emissary to spend a lot of bandwidth. And now I am often coming up with things and going, hey guys, this might be a problem. And they're going, you couldn't have said that 2 years ago, Flynn, come on. You know, it's like, I'm sorry, I really am. It's a hard problem. So in the spirit of, I feel like people coming to the Living on the Edge podcast ideally would be getting real information from people working with this stuff as opposed to a lot of political spin or something like that. And in the spirit of trying to be straightforward and honest about where I think the Gateway API is. Yeah, there are a ton of things that you just can't do in Gateway API yet that I think are necessary for an API gateway product to be able to do. Maybe the most obvious answer or example there is, you know, retries, not part of Gateway API yet. But yeah, and so you know, Envoy Gateway is having to think about things like, well, maybe we'll just do retries as an HTTP filter. And Linkerd is in exactly the same situation because we need to be able to do retries, and we're probably going to need to do it as an HTTP filter, which kind of makes me sad. One of the official takes from the Gateway API group is policy attachment. I finally may have figured out a way to articulate some of my feeling about policy attachment, which is that, so in emissary land, we have Jane, the application developer, and we have Julian, the ops guy. Gateway API borrowed that role-based concept from emissary and extended it to have Charlie, the cluster provider, Ian, the infrastructure engineer, and Anna, the app developer. And the really interesting thing about policy attachment is that it's probably impossible. I used to say definitely impossible, but I'm going to back off a little bit now and say only probably impossible to teach Anna how to use policy attachment.
I agree. The Gateway API is going to be interesting. You know, it's an important thing. I appreciate what Rob and Nick have done. Speaking of KubeCon, I know you'll be there. We're going to be there at booth 012 and at the Telepresence and Emissary Pavilion kiosks. Where can folks find you at the conference?
Where they will find me, I will be at, for most of the time, I will be either at the Linkerd booth in the Project Pavilion or the Buoyant booth in the sponsor showcase or whatever they call it. Yeah, the sponsors hall. I will be delivering the Emissary Maintainer Track talk with Hamza Qudsi of Ambassador Labs. I will be doing a talk about adopting the Gateway API without ruining your reputation. That is on on Thursday at 11 a.m. The Emissary Maintainer Track talk is on Tuesday at 4:30. And Tuesday at 5:30, I will be doing a panel with some other service mesh folks that's moderated by Keith Maddox of Microsoft. And it'll be me, Lin Sun from, Lin Sun is from Solo, Thomas Graf is from Isovalent, and John Howard is from Google. We will be talking about the down and dirty being in the trenches of how service meshes are awful and how we hate everything and all that, or something like that. Yeah. And I will definitely be finding you at KubeCon. Yeah.
Thanks, Lynn. Sure to sync up at the conference, maybe at Kuberoki. We'll see. Anyways, I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. We'll do it again sometime.
Folks, stay tuned for more episodes coming later this year. Thanks.